host, Jeff Ragavan, and welcome to the Alchemy Podcast, where we're on a quest to explore the intersection of cannabis, compliance, and creative in the marketing world today and beyond. Welcome back to this week's episode of Alchemy. Very excited to welcome a special guest of Christine De La Rosa. She's the CEO and co-founder of The People's Ecosystem. Christine, great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
Yes, and thank you for taking the time. I know you've been running around on the circuit and speaking and all the events that you've been attending. So really appreciate you coming on. And lots of great stuff to talk about, you know, but just for everybody who's tuning in right now, if you don't know Christine, she's a force. She's a great background. She actually, fun fact, was a senior database architect at Verizon, which I definitely want to get to that in a second, Christine. But you were also named one of the 35 most influential women in cannabis about a year ago. You were also named one of the top 10 women to watch. You're on a ton of advisory boards. You're doing a ton of great work, and you're really moving the, you know, the cannabis industry in such a great pace. So thank you for everything that you do. But I think, why don't we kick off the show and talk to us a little bit about your career evolution, like being a database architect and now kind of running, you know, a company on the cannabis side is pretty big shift. Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about your career.
Sure. I mean, I have a bachelor's and master's, both of them in art, having nothing to do with database architecture, but just kind of fell into that like right at the beginning of Web 2 or Web 1.0, and did that for many years and thought that this would be something I would do for the rest of my life. I love doing it. I'm definitely a geek girl, but then I almost died in 2010, and I had a pulmonary embolism while driving down a freeway.
Oh my God.
I'd been sick about 3 years prior, but nobody could diagnose me. So I just kept working because I'm kind of a workaholic. Mm-hmm. I ended up in the hospital for 7 days, and that's when they diagnosed me with pretty severe systemic lupus. So that was what had been wrong for me for the last 3 years. So that put me down a trajectory where I worked for probably another 3 months. I ended up taking disability, and then I ended up getting very sick and just never going back to work. Mm-hmm. And I had 11 doctors. That were treating me at the time in California. They gave me 11 pills, how fun, that I was taking to try to mitigate pain and inflammation and all of the symptoms that were going around with lupus. And of those 11 pills, 5 of them were opioids. So I had in my medicine cabinet hydrocortone, hydromorphine, Oxycontin, Tramadol, fentanyl patches. And this is all stuff that I took on any given day based on pain level. And then, of course, I was on all the other stuff like, you know, Plaquenil, which is what they told you should take for COVID 2 years ago. I was on gabapentin. I was on Lyrica, all to try to get my body to function. But it didn't function. So for 5 years, I was pretty much homebound. I couldn't really walk. The last 2 years that I was really sick, they came out with a brand new drug called Benlysta. I used to go to the hospital every month to get that done. It's like an infusion. And that let me walk with a cane for about 2 weeks out of every month. And so that's how my life was for 5 years. I went from traveling all over the world, working with Verizon Wireless and then a lot of places in South America, because I was a consultant prior to actually taking a real job my whole life.
Yeah.
And so when I got, it was New Year's Day, 2015, I remember that so clearly. I was putting together, I've had a pill box, right? Pills that I had to take every day. And I just was putting those 11 pills into this box. And I thought, oh my God, how many pills am I going to be taking if I make it to 60? I'm in my 40s now, right? Yeah. And I started to look for alternatives. And I kept coming. This is 2015. There was nothing but a bunch of like really stoned people on YouTube talking about cannabis at the time. It's not like it was now. Right. Yeah. But I kept, you know, I kept like looking, I kept getting back to THC and THCV, and I had some stuff around CBD, and I just started really looking for a regimen that might work for me. I really thought I was going to find like a, you know, green tea regimen, but it ended up being a cannabis regimen. I went to my local dispensary, which I had never thought of doing in the 5 years I had been homebound, right. Mostly because I'm of Mexican descent. And one of the things that's definitely a thread for Mexican descent people is that you don't want to smoke marijuana because they're going to think you're a lazy Mexican. And I'm not a lazy Mexican, right?
Right.
So I was had a lot of fear around that propaganda of being seen as that, which is why I didn't for 5 years look for cannabis as an alternative. But after 5 years of being pretty much sick, almost dying, almost died again in 2012 from pericarditis, you're like, I'm going to try anything. I'm going to literally try anything. And that's how I got to cannabis. And I started figuring out my regimen. It took me 9 months to get off all 11 pills, including the opioids and the monthly infusion that I was doing. And I have been in remission since September 2015.
Amazing.
And to this day, I use the same regimen when I'm sick, like every day. I'm not sick, but I always have lupus, but I'll use it every day. And then I'll up it if I'm in the middle of a flare. Mm-hmm. But I'm able to walk. I'm able to build companies. These are things I could not have done. When you're on hydromorphine, you cannot do that shit. You know, pardon me, but you know, so that's how I got to cannabis. So I could have easily gone back to Verizon Wireless. They loved me. I loved them. They had really good, I made a lot of money at that. Like, it was great. It was awesome. Mm-hmm. My bonuses were just, I was a top tier at Verizon Wireless. And then but I was so mad. I was so mad because so many people of color, so many women at that time in 2015, there was such a huge stigma around cannabis, right? There was a whole, you know, thread about what cannabis actually did. It made you tired. It made you lazy. It made you sleepy. It made you a stoner. It made you this. And there were tons and tons of women that were ill with lupus, with, you know, other autoimmune diseases. There were tons and tons of Black and brown people also really, really sick, where that were also taking opioids, like they were Pez, like as a Pez dispenser. And there was nobody in, even in California at that time, that looked like me. And I thought, I can't go back to Verizon Wireless. I have to create a company that's made of people that look like me so that we can talk to them and transition them over to more holistic medicine. Because everybody of color, whether you're Asian, you're Black, you're brown, and you're indigenous, there is a whole thread around the war on drugs, around DARE, around, you know, just say no, that is deeply ingrained in my age group. I'm a Gen X. And, you know, I love seeing Gen Zs because they're like, we'll do whatever. But Gen X, there's a huge thing, boomers, Gen X, around that war on drugs. And so many people not looking on how to use a holistic medicine instead of a prescribed medicine that is highly addictive and will kill you.
Right. Totally. Well, I think you're doing amazing, amazing work. And I'm glad that, you know, the regimen that you're on now has really kind of transformed you too. I think that's important. Yeah. So many people who've come on this show, whether it's, you know, we've had a mom whose, you know, daughter has cancer and she's literally moved to a regimen of cannabis and, it, you know, her daughter is getting better from it, you know, which is also highly controversial because, you know, she's like six, but then also so many people who are utilizing cannabis for whatever the ailment might be that's helping them with their daily lives to get them off of prescription drugs. So it's great to hear your story. You know, I think it's obviously Women's History Month and we've been featuring, you know, a ton of incredible women leaders in the last week and we'll continue to do so over the next couple of weeks as well. So I'm excited to have you on the show today, you know, but I would love for you to talk, you know, a little bit too about, you know, one, obviously, you're running a business, you know, it's a woman-owned business. And, you know, the cannabis space has been very male-dominated in the past. And there's many, many more women who have, you know, started companies and are really doing incredible, incredible work. So it'd be helpful to hear from you. Are there any challenges that you're facing today being a woman and running a business in cannabis? Or are you thriving? Are there, you know, challenges and red flags? Like, talk to us. You know, we've got so many folks that listen on this show. And I think it's so important to really talk about what's happening in the industry.
Well, I think that if you're a woman, you automatically have trouble in any space. So let's just be really clear, like whether it's cannabis, whether it's CPG, whether it's technology, whatever, if it's STEM, if you're a woman, you're going to have a problem. I think the thing that's important to understand is to understand the power of being a woman within this problem. Because what we do know is just the level of buying power that women have in the US alone, but also globally. I think that we have to understand the power we hold within that. When you look at who actually has the purse strings in the US household and who decides what gets purchased, it is overwhelmingly female. And when you're looking at cannabis, the largest group of people that is going to be purchasing cannabis over the next 10 years is going to be women. And if you are not diverse in your C-suite or in your director suite, if you do not understand the power of the women, the woman who hold the dollars, you are going to fail. That's just easy. And the thing is that a lot of times I see really large companies, whether it's in cannabis or outside of cannabis, and they're like, we have this person and she's a woman and isn't that awesome? And we're so diverse. Mm-hmm. And then you see what they do and you're like, she's the director of marketing. She's the chief of marketing. She's the person over here doing human resources, rah, rah, rah. And I'm like, that's bullshit. And also you're going to fail because unless you see women and people of color in positions of power where they actually control the P&L, mm-hmm. your company's not going to make it. And I say, and people always think I'm crazy. Like, it's made it this whole time. What are you talking about? How is that going to change? This is how it's been working for decades, for centuries. And I'm like, read the room, guys. Read the damn room. The Gen Z, our Gen Z, over 50% of them are people of color. That's Gen Z. They carry a supercomputer in their pocket. They're going to be able to look at your board of directors on any given day. Your millennials are 45% BIPOC and women. And this is the thing that's so amazing about people that are leading these companies is they don't know how to read the room. They think they're still in an era that doesn't exist anymore, and they haven't figured that out yet. But they will, because there's another generation after Gen Z that they're teaching. That's going to be their kids. So I always tell people, if you don't have women in major positions of power to really understand your demographic that you're going into, especially in cannabis, because cannabis culture comes out of the underground, out of Black people, out of Brown people. This is where culture comes from. And if you don't have it, you're not going to make it. And you can see that on some of these brands that we see right now that have failed miserably. And why? Because they didn't know how to read the room.
Right. Well, I'm glad that you brought that up too, because, you know, I was doing, obviously, everybody who comes on the show, we do a little bit of research on, but, you know, I saw that you're also the lead author for Gender Parity in the C-Suite, right? You're also a co-author of Pathways to Equity Ownership in the Cannabis Space, which was part of NCIA and the ArcView group's gender, you know, equity cannabis white papers, which I thought was amazing. And so, you know, talk to me a little bit about, you know, what you're doing. Obviously, you're this incredible thought leader, but how you're really trying to get that out there into the cannabis industry and change people's minds and perceptions on how they should be operating.
Absolutely. I think that I use the ecosystem kind of as my guiding post. So when you're looking at, you know, how are you transitioning what you learned in the C-suite paper? And I learned a lot doing that paper, like the fact that women founders tend to make anywhere between 7 and 15% more in net revenue than companies that are run by men. Mm-hmm. And so in my company, when I decided to put together a company, it used to be just two of us. It was me and Charlene, who's one of my best friends. Back in 2015, we were in the legacy market. We transitioned to the legal market. So when we got our first round of funding and we started to make money and we were going to build out our team, I said, like, who are we really looking for? We want a dynamic group of people. We want to have best representation. And so when you look at our company, you know, we're looking at 88% of the people on my executive team are women. 72% of my executive team are people of color. 45% of my executive team are LGBTQIA. That's mm-hmm. how you do it. You build the company that you and the people that are part of that company so that when somebody is looking at who your company is, they clearly see that they're represented in that, right? It's easy for other folks to be like, oh, I'm just going to hire this one Black person. I'm just going to hire this one Brown person. But when people will know that that's not the whole thing. And they'll know that you don't actually have gender parity because everybody else is a white guy, right? It's like that doesn't work. And nobody's dumb like that anymore. So I think that that's kind of what we did is I really took that paper to heart, to be honest with you. I was like, oh, well, if we make 17% more net revenue, why wouldn't I want those people to be in positions of power that manage the P&L? Why would I choose something else, you know? And yeah, I mean, it was really amazing. And then when we started to do a lot of research into like the power of women dollars, power of people of color, when we look at, you know, that we look at, you know, the Latin population in the US, 1 out of 5 people are Latino or Latinx. Mm-hmm. They have $1.6 trillion of buying power. When we look at Black Americans, 1 in 7 people are Black and they have 1.5 $4 trillion in buying power in the U.S. When we look at the Asian market, one out of 14 people is Asian in the U.S., most of them concentrated on the West Coast, $1 trillion worth of buying power. So you combine those and you're looking at about $4 trillion of buying power. You don't want to leave any of that on the table.
For sure. I think that's incredible. And there's obviously there's so much opportunity out there and so many populations that we really should be focusing on. You know, one thing I did want to bring up today as well is obviously there's a lot happening in New York. You know, I know that you've really advised, you know, governments across the whole country on social equity. And, you know, you've written a ton of positioning papers for New York on legalization around cannabis regulation itself. So thank you, by the way, because I'm a New Yorker.
Okay.
Long overdue. But also, I know that you're, you know, part of the New York Cannabis Industry Association, your special advisor. You're also focusing on, you know, social and economic equity and social justice. And so there's so much chatter. It's obviously a very hot topic now. But give us kind of a little bit of a lens on what you think is in store for the New York cannabis market. You know, we have tons of people who've been on the show, like they're talking about what it can be, what it will be. But what I'm curious what you think, kind of being involved here, at least on the advising side.
Well, you know, I hate to make those types of statements just because you never know what's going to happen.
Right, it hasn't happened yet, but yeah.
I know, but the thing is like in Illinois, everybody's like touting it, including me. I was like, oh my God, it's in the legislation. It's real. And we see where Chicago, we see where Illinois is. They're nowhere. 3 years later, they're nowhere. They've made such a mess of that. So I have high hopes for New York, but I can tell you, you know, I have a very big red flag for New York that I think New Yorkers should really be looking at. And in the MRTA, which is a piece of legislation, which is the thing that everybody points to in Illinois about why they can't do something a certain way because of the legislation, because that's the legislation. In the MRTA, there's supposed to be a community advisory council. It is part of the legislation. And they have not formed that. And that that advisory board was supposed to advise the OCM. It's there. Right. It's written. They haven't even picked up a finger to do that.
Well, why have they not done it yet?
Because it's not their top priority. They said that in one of the meetings, I think in December or January, might've been January. Somebody asked them like, where's that advisory board from the community? And they're like, well, it's not our top priority. And when you say that community is not your top priority, then that's a red flag for me. That something is going on that is going to come out in 18 months and everybody's going to be like, oh, here's some stuff happening over here that's really, you know, shady, suspect. And here's why they didn't want that community advisory board, because there's really no reason why you shouldn't have put that advisory board in place. That should have been the very first thing that you should have put in place. But there's a reason they didn't do that. So that's a big red flag for me in New York. And also, of course, the $200 million fund that literally every person is writing about in every magazine as if it's like God's gift to the world. And I keep telling people, read the damn fine print. It's a debt facility. It's a debt fund. That's not a social equity fund. Social equity fund and debt funds are totally different things, but they're calling the debt fund the social equity fund. So I have a lot of concern for the social equity folks there, but you know, we'll see. I mean, I have high hopes too. Like I'm not just being like, oh, it's going to be terrible. I'm hoping they know something that we who have been affected since California and all of the other states before New York, that they know something we don't. I don't know what that is, but I'm trying to hope for it.
I mean, I think at this point, you know, any new states that are coming on board for, you know, recreation beyond medical should learn from the mistakes of other states to do it right, you know?
Yeah. And that was the thing that was so wild to me. It was like the governor went on the month-long tour via Zoom talking about this $200 million fund. And then last week, they released the RFI asking, how do we put that fund together? I'm like, how are you doing a train show an entire month? And then you put an RFI and says, yeah, can y'all tell us how you think we should do it? I was like, so big red flag. That's the second red flag I have. But we'll see how they do.
Amazing. Well, listen, I'm looking at the time and somehow we're already up. But it's been awesome having you on the show, and you've so much insight and so much wisdom, and, you know, appreciate everything that you've talked to us about today. I know that you're already in Austin.
Yes.
Let us know, like, where are you going to be on a couple panels coming up in the next few days? Where can people find you?
Yes. I'm going to be at the South by panel on Monday for Legacy to Legal at the Hilton downtown. The very next day, I'm going to be at the same Hilton, but I'm going to be talking about investing in diversity for cannabis companies and why it's important for you to do that. We have a happy hour. It's the official happy hour, South by Southwest cannabis track, which will be right after, also at the Hilton, Salon C. And then next week I'll be in Miami. So
busy.
Catch me if you can.
Awesome. Well, Christine De La Rosa, CEO and co-founder of The People's Ecosystem, thank you so much for coming on the show and giving us your wisdom.
All right. Thank you for having me.
This episode of the Alchemy Podcast was brought to you by Philo. Thanks for tuning in. And if you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and share.